Good afternoon. As announced, we're going to look tonight at perseverance in the Christian race. You know, even I can start a marathon. I don't know about finishing it, but I can start it. The challenge is not just in starting, it's of course in finishing and finishing strong. And that takes perseverance. It also takes an understanding of where your real strength comes from as we're fighting spiritual battles. One of my favorite verses in the Bible is from Isaiah chapter 40. Do you not know, have you not heard, that those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength? They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. I don't know about you, but I like the idea of running and not getting tired. And walking and walking and walking and not becoming weary. Only way you could possibly do that is if you are able to tap into God's power and figure out through that power how to persevere. Jesus said in Luke 21 and verse 29, in your perseverance, you will possess your souls. So obviously, this is one of the vital keys to success and stability in our Christian walk. So what exactly is perseverance? Mr. Webster, help me out. Merriam-Webster's dictionary says that it is to continue steadily and firmly in a pursuit, especially in the face of opposition, to endure. And I particularly like the fact that in the scripture, when it talks about this particular trait, it frequently is connected with the metaphor of running. So we're going to do three things this afternoon together. We're going to look at how do we avoid weariness, what is the key to success, and how should we run this race. I want to go back in time to the fall of 2013 when I first came here to be with you as your evangelist. And we talked about important elements needed for a bright future. We were talking about what we could do to spark a revival among us. And there's a number of things, of course, that biblically would need to be in order. But I think there's five key pillars, and I think church growth research would indicate this as well. First, you have to have a proper vision, proper long-term planning, proper idea of where you're going. Otherwise, you just sort of mark time and feel like you're just sort of spinning your wheels. And then once you articulate a clear vision, which we have done, of course, with our vision statement and our regular planning and assessments and that kind of thing moving forward, you have to have personal involvement. It's not enough just to have a nice sounding vision. People have to buy in and own that particular vision. You want people as much as possible to be participants in the Lord's work, not just spectators. And as you move forward over time, people do become weary. It's easy to drift and lose focus, and it's important to maintain perseverance. And throughout all of this, you have to have good leadership. The ancient nation of Israel was only as strong as their kings challenged them to be. Never better than their leaders, sometimes worse. And good leadership is key. And as mentioned in the prayer tonight, what a blessing to have so many deacons and elders and teachers and members that are involved in just working together in a unified way. So if you have unity and you have these other elements all together, what you have is a winning hand. But we really haven't talked since 2013 about this subject of perseverance. So I think it's time that we revisit this. And it is a blessing to realize that Kirkland is and has experienced a significant revival. It was encouraging to hear two couples, four additional people placing membership this morning. Since January 1st of this year, that's 23 precious souls that have been added to our number. In 2014, we were blessed with 36 additions, and that's the most ever in any given year. And so at a six-month mark, to have 23 is meaning we're picking up speed here, and the Lord continues to bless our efforts moving forward. We started today officially our deaf ministry, and right now we just have one regular person coming, but we're making efforts to advertise that and to have more people, hopefully, that we can reach from the deaf community, and please keep that effort in your prayers. Back in early 2014, we set out what we called a decade of destiny, and we did something kind of scary. A lot of folks aren't used to thinking about 10 years ahead, but we planned out and thought about things 10 years moving forward. And we're about that halfway mark. And that's oftentimes in a race where you start to kind of run out of juice, kind of really need to be encouraged. And so I think it's appropriate for us as more and more things continue to one layer after another be laid out for us here at Kirkland, that we think about the importance of persevering as we run this race. So what does the Bible say about how should we run? Well, we should run first and foremost to win. The Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to receive the prize." And wow, what a wonderful prize that is, a crown that is incorruptible and undefiled and that is reserved in heaven for you. So if we're going to run this race so as to win, that obviously implies that we're going to be taking this seriously and we're going to be putting forth the maximum effort. I want you to imagine that you are deciding to attend a track meet. And you're sitting there in the stands, and all the different teams are there with their chosen contestants, and they get down ready to start the race, and you hear the announcer say, "Timers and judges, ready, on your mark," and they shoot the gun, and boom, they're off and running. Well, what would you think if maybe two of the six people in this race, instead of running and obviously doing the best they can, decide to just start walking around the track, just sort of taking a nice stroll? "How you doing? Good to see you." Don't want to break a sweat, don't want to really, you know, strain themselves very much. How would you feel if you came to watch runners run and watch a race, and a couple of the runners just decide to take a stroll? Now, they stay on the track, but they're really not putting any effort. They're not running so as to win at all. You'd probably feel like, what is wrong with these two people? Why bother to even sign up for a race if you're not going to do your best and at least try to win? And what terrible representatives they are of the team that they're supposed to be representing. What an embarrassment. And if you thought all of those things, you would be exactly right. I mean, how bizarre that would be, right? I imagine if people booed at track meets, they'd boo at that. What a thing to be ashamed of. But you know what? I wonder how the world reacts to so many people who are professing the name of Christ, but pretty much are lukewarm, not putting out that much effort, looking to do the minimum. I mean, good people, and they're in the right track, but they're just taking a stroll. They're going to serve the Lord when it's convenient. If it's not ever convenient, well, then I'm not in. We're not going to win the hearts of people if we're not serious about running the race. I mean, you're just a laughingstock if you're in a track meet and you just choose to take a walk. And sadly, I think sometimes the world points its finger at us, so many people that claim to be Christian. If you ask them, they think they're going to heaven, but the truth of the matter is they're not putting forth much effort to make a difference. So no wonder the Apostle Paul says, you need to run so you can win the prize. Now, at this point, the analogy breaks down a little bit. Because in a race, like in the Olympics, you know, there's gold, silver, and bronze, and then everybody else, they're losers. They don't place at all. It's not the way it is in the Christian race. We all need to do our best. We all need to run so as to win. But we all help each other in the race. And if one of us is struggling or whatever, we're there to help. And we all want everybody to succeed. And they need to put forth their own effort. But we're all here to help each other get to the end. And everybody who is faithful unto death receives the prize, the crown of life. And that's why we follow Jesus, not alone, but together. And we need to help each other persevere, especially if any one of us start to feel overwhelmed or start to feel weak. So we run with maximum effort, we run with determination, and with a sense of single-mindedness. I love how the Apostle Paul says, this one thing I do, as he looks forward to that which is ahead. When you look at all these different verbs that are used in connection with what we should be doing in running the race, there's words like run and stretch and press and work. And Jesus said in Luke 13, verse 24, strive to enter in at the straight gate. So it's difficult at times, but we're supposed to be so excited about the noble purpose and the amazing high calling and prize that's available to us that it keeps us moving forward. So we run with determination and we run so we are forward looking. Notice what Paul says here. He says, forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize. When we look at our automobiles, we've got this big front windshield so we can see. And we do have rearview mirrors, both on the sides and up at the top. And we need to look back in the rearview mirror to see what's behind us. But if you spend too much time staring at the rearview mirrors, eventually you're going to crash and not see what's in front of you. And so you need to know where you're going. You need to focus on moving forward and only use the rearview mirrors to gain perspective. And the same thing is true in life. People can so easily get bogged down with mistakes they've made in the past or offenses that they've had to deal with, that maybe they're struggling with bitterness as they think about how someone they feel offended them in some way. Paul said, I put all this baggage behind so I can focus on running the race and winning that race effectively. When the children of Israel were in captivity, they had a hard time not just sort of licking their wounds. You know, we have a book called the Book of Lamentations. And boy, they had reasons to lament because their capital city and their nation was in ruins. And at that point, nobody knew whether they'd ever be able to come back and rebuild or not, at least from a practical perspective, even though God had promised them that would be the case. And so their nation is destroyed. They're taken into captivity. They've lost their land and their homes. And Isaiah comes to them in Isaiah 43, 18 and 19 and says, remember not the former things. Consider them not. Don't dwell on them any longer. I get the impression they basically were told, will you please stop talking about the past? And he starts pointing them to this great messianic hope and what God had planned for them in the future. Do you know your mind always moves in the direction of its most dominant thought? And if our most dominant thoughts are negative, particularly negative things about the past, it just poisons our mental health and any hope for optimism for the future. It happened after the Civil War was over in this country of ours. The bitterness, the hatred, the resentment in people's lives, no one had seen anything like it before after the Civil War. Everyone seemingly had been wounded in some way by the war. After it was all over, the guns fell silent, but the people didn't. Many were sour. Too many were filled with hatred. Too many wouldn't forget, and they wouldn't forgive their enemies. But there was one among the very few, though, who was big enough to insist on peace. And if there was anyone who would seemingly have the right to hold a grudge, it was he, but he didn't. General Robert E. Lee, just as he was the leader of the rebel army after the war, was a leader for reconciliation. He knew the war was over, and he knew the nation demanded a new attitude for a new day. Once upon a time, a lady in Lexington, Virginia, where General Lee lived after the war, showed him the scarred remains of a tree in her yard. All the limbs on that tree had been shot off by federal artillery during a raid. Griping, complaining, and bitter, she took General Lee out into her yard and showed it to him. "See what they did to my tree," she said. And thinking he would share her sense of outrage, she waited expectantly for him to chime in and condemn those Yankees. After a pause, though, she was shocked, for this is what General Lee said. "Cut it down, dear madam, and forget it." You know, that's just pretty good advice a lot of times, isn't it? Sometimes you just need to, instead of dwelling on hurts and disappointments and wrongs and past defeats, you just need to cut it down and forget it and move forward. And that's what the Apostle Paul is saying he did. He's saying, forgetting what happened in the past, straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal. So if there's something troubling you tonight, if there's something that you just have a hard time letting go of, I just hope you will pray that the Lord will help you to cut it down and forget it so you can begin a new day. As you run the race, you need to run it with discipline. Now, I like the fact that we all say we are disciples of Jesus, but the root of the word disciple is found the word discipline. I mean, you can't really be a disciple of Jesus without disciplining yourself to do so, to take up his cross daily and follow him. And a part of that, of course, is denying self. Paul goes on to say, using this image of the Olympics, which had been around about 300 years when he wrote this, "Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things." Obviously, if you're serious about being an athlete, you know, that kind of training that's involved in getting ready for the competition is a serious discipline. And he says, "I discipline my body and make it my slave." He goes on to say, "lest I myself one day might find myself disqualified." So I want you to notice, he ran with confidence, but he wasn't cocky. He knew that he himself could be disqualified, that he could, as he runs the race, fall into temptation and fall. So he's always on guard as he runs this race with discipline. He runs with discipline and confidence. He says, "Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim." In other words, I'm not just a shadow boxer. I'm not just up here sort of beating the wind. I'm not just beating the air. I know what I'm doing, and I know where I'm headed, and I know what God has called me to do, and I'm serious about doing this. I'm not cocky. I recognize there's no room for a cavalier attitude about this. The devil's after me. I'm determined to resist him so that he will flee. When I was in the 10th grade, I decided to join the Monroe High swim team. And I was trying to figure out early on what I was going to do, what strokes I wanted to choose to swim. And I noticed the longest standing record that they had at my high school at the time was the 100-yard butterfly. And it was a pretty good time. And I remember deciding, I don't know what possessed me, but I want to break that school record. And I figured I could make up with natural talent, I could make up the lack of natural talent with discipline. And so I started swimming close to 3 miles a day, waking up really early and swimming in the morning before school, and then after school having another workout at night. Did that about 5 days a week. And I was just really serious. I had lofty goals. I wanted to break that school record. I wanted to be captain of the swim team. I wanted to go all city, and I wanted to be all American. And I had to show a lot of perseverance to do that. I remember my swim coach. It's like a second father to me, Bernie Sherman. I remember him walking on some of those early morning swims as the steam's coming up off the water in Southern California. I remember him walking along and saying, "Hunter, if you're going to be an average athlete, all you do is swim till your side begins to hurt and then you stop." Because that's what an average athlete does. But if you're going to be an above average athlete, you swim until your side hurts and then you continue to swim until you feel pain. And then you stop. But he said, if you want to be a champion, if you want to be a winner, if you want to accomplish your goals, you have to swim through the hurt, through the pain, until you literally feel like you have agony in your side as you're breathing and gasping your breath. And you need to persevere. And your body saves this pint of blood in its spleen. And if you work it out properly, you'll be able to, in a race, trigger a release of that half a pint of blood or so that's filled with oxygen. And it gives you this great burst of energy as you learn to pace yourself and finish the race strong and steadfast. And I was fortunate enough, with a lot of good help and a lot of hard work, to break that school record in the 10th grade and in the 11th grade and in the 12th grade and to go all city and to be captain of the swim team. And I wish I could tell you I went all American, but I missed it by 0.2 seconds. Do you imagine that? 0.2 seconds. Heartbreaker. But, you know, the thing that I really learned from that experience was I learned a lot about discipline and what it takes to persevere and to be a winner in athletics. And that's exactly the figure that we're given here spiritually. We need to be willing to not easily be discouraged or to stop or to give up just because we're hitting some obstacles and we're running into some tough times. That's why the Bible says you run with perseverance. Throw off everything that hinders you, anything that's getting in the way. You got something like a, you know, ball and chain around one of your ankles. Obviously, if you're serious about winning the race, you do everything you can to get rid of whatever that is. Get rid of the sin that so easily entangles us, and let us instead, now that we've broken free from all of these encumbrances, run with perseverance the race that is marked out before us. Another translation says, you run with great endurance. We need to remember that the Christian race is not a sprint. The race of grace is clearly a marathon. And we have to do what my coach taught me. He called it optimal level training, which means you have to learn to pace yourself so you have enough energy left not to completely run out of gas on the last lap. They used to call the 100 butterfly the gut stroke. And the problem was doing this in the butterfly just wore people out. And most of the time by the fourth lap, they just can't hardly bring their arms over their head. And that's where they lose the race. So you have to practice so you can hit the third flip turn. And now that you've only got 25 yards left on the last lap, now you give it all you got. It was so exciting to be able to pace yourself and still have energy left while everybody else is about running out of gas and you pass everybody up on the last lap. It was really neat to be announced the winner and have everybody cheering. The only problem was you had to literally pull me out of the water because I was so exhausted and I'd given it my all. I mean, that's kind of the way I hope we all can finish the Christian race. You know, finish strong. Just don't start the race. Finish it. Go all the way. Be determined not to burn out. The way you avoid burnout is if you need to pace yourself, you do. If you need help from others, you do. If you need a pause or some recreation occasionally, by all means, take it. But stay on the track and make sure you're serious about winning this marathon for the Lord. Aesop's fable says, the race is not always to the swift, but to the sure and to the steadfast. So, as we're all busy about our Father's business, we need to think about what's the optimal pace as we run our race. Looking to Jesus, of course, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame. How in the world did Jesus succeed having the power at any moment to call 12 legions of angels down and say, enough, I've had it? You know, I keep on hearing that when individuals are tortured, that everybody eventually has a breaking point. And Jesus, who was the Son of Man as well as the Son of God, he didn't break. How did he do that? Well, this verse tells us that his mindset, so much of this is mental, his mindset was not on how awful the cross was going to be, but how wonderful the finish line was going to be when he fulfills his mission, does not abort, pleases the Father, and becomes the Savior of the world. It was the joy that was set before him that kept him going, caused him to complete his mission. And it's a joy that is set before us as we focus on the prize that will do the same. You know, sometimes you're kind of hard on Peter, and for good reason. Peter's kind of impetuous. He frequently speaks without thinking, and he has to be rebuked. But you know what? I like Peter's spirit because he always gets back up. And you know what? Aside from Jesus Christ, he's the only human being that ever walked on water. Ever thought about that? The others weren't willing to get out of the boat. But Jesus said, come on out with me. And he did. And he's walking on water along with Jesus. And as long as he had faith and he kept his eye on Jesus, he could have stayed there afloat, walking on water. But what happened? He kind of thought, is this really happening? And then he starts feeling the winds and the waves and the spray on his face. And he starts looking at the darkness of the sea and he starts to sink. And then Jesus walks over and is so kind to him. Instead of fussing at Peter and saying, Peter, you messed up again. He just grabs him, lifts him up and says, why did you lack faith? Next time, keep the faith and stay focused on me, and you will be able to walk on water. And that's what happens to us, isn't it? We get distracted. We start to doubt, and then we sink. This says, run the race but with faith and keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. And it's amazing what then he will do through you as you walk on water to do and to fulfill his will. How do we avoid becoming weary in well-doing? Well, we have to realize that as we are running the Christian race, if we become weary, it's a self-imposed condition. Remember, if we're really plugging into God's power, we're told we can run and not grow weary. We can walk and walk and not faint. Look at Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. you know, he's just waiting to be arrested, knowing what that's going to mean. The cross is just hours away. And he's there praying fervently. And he says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow. I mean, Jesus appears to be praying, saying, you know, I just, this cup, I don't think the cup there is the cross. I really think the cup is the emotional turmoil and agony that he was feeling as his sweat dropped, as it were, drops of blood. And he's saying and praying to God, can you help me through this? I'm overwhelmed with sorrow. And he says, Abba, Father, the closest, most intimate term you can have. See, he always kept this close relationship with the Father. And he says, everything is possible with you. I know that if it's your will that I endure this, that I'll be able to do it. And not my will, but thine be done. And of course, an angel was sent later to comfort him. I think his prayer was answered. And we need to understand that we can receive the strength to persevere if we just focus in on God's will and stay focused and complete the task and not ever consider aborting the mission. We need to learn to depend upon God as the ultimate source of strength. I think about what Paul went through as a minister. You know, Paul didn't have a wife to support him. I don't know where I'd be at different times where I was sort of discouraged if Gail wasn't there to help lift me up and pray with me. Paul didn't have that. In spite of problems and pressures and persecutions, he persevered, though the outward man was decaying, the inward man was renewed day by day, and he kept strong for Jesus Christ. And he even says, when I am weak, then I am strong, because that enables him to even plug into the power of God even more. One of the things we have to realize, particularly I think as we're sort of at this halfway mark of some of these 10-year plans and goals, we need to realize the three D's are tools of Satan. Discouragement, despair, depression. That's what Satan wants Christian soldiers to have to endure, because he knows that God cannot use a discouraged or depressed person effectively in carrying out his will. I'm not saying that someone gets discouraged that they've lost their salvation, but I am saying that they've lost their way as far as maintaining their joy and being a tool to really move the kingdom forward. And so if Satan can discourage us and we allow that to happen, then he wins in that sense. So the most powerful tool that Satan has at his disposal, especially for good, righteous people that come to services like this on a Sunday afternoon, thank you for being here. It's just for us to allow ourselves to be discouraged. Even though there oftentimes are things that are discouraging, disappointing, got to recognize that that in and of itself is something that can make us not be able to really run the race so as to win. You know, we talked a couple months ago about the Christian armor and how there's no room on the back, because there's no room for the Christian to retreat. You're completely vulnerable when you start to doubt and retreat, because Satan now, those fiery darts, see, you're losing faith, so the shield's not there to block the darts or to extinguish them, and you are just a sitting duck for all types of terrible things to happen in your life. But if you resist Satan and you by faith stay moving forward, even when you're tired, you move forward, that's when God will give you the victory. Have you become weary? The Bible says, let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not grow weary and faint not. Obviously, the key to perseverance is faith. Hebrews 11 and verse 6, without faith, it is impossible to please him. True faith doesn't contemplate the difficulty and carrying out God's will. It merely seeks the will of God and then launches out by faith. And then you wait on the Lord to give you the resources to move forward. You and I have to remember the necessity of planning big and thinking big, because a big faith is what comes when we serve a big God. And it's almost as if the cross of Jesus Christ comes along and it knocks out the apostrophe T in the word can't. So we in Christ can say with Paul, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. No room for retreat in the Lord's army. No place for shirkers when duty calls. And that's when we need to realize that faith is the victory. And I believe as we move forward and we look to the future, our only limitation is the size of our faith. Remember, he's able to do exceedingly abundantly, even more than we ask or think, according to the power that worketh within us. And true faith is not just starting well, but ending well. It means you persevere. Henry Ford said, if you think you can or you think you can't, you're right either way. A lot of truth in that. If we have made little itty-bitty plans and we therefore put forth just very little action, we're going to have little results. But in order to have big things and to have big results, you need to think big and have a big faith and stay focused with your eye on Jesus as you run the race. Sometimes folks in local churches sort of think, well, what can I do? I mean, how much good can one person do? Well, my answer to that is a lot, especially if they're working with other people who are also by faith acting and trying to discern God's will. I don't want to embarrass Nick Affolter tonight, but it's completely his idea to start these meetups. He heard about it happening in some other congregation and they were getting good results. And so, you know, he didn't have a meeting with the elders or ask me. He just said, let's just do this app, and got with Daniel Stouse and just started having meetups. And you know what? His own individual initiative was such, that's perfectly fine. You can start a meetup and say, I want to meet with people and study the Bible. You don't have to ask anybody's permission or go through some sort of leadership meeting. I mean, it just sort of happened organically. And then started having success. And then other men on their own said, yeah, let's try that. And now we have four meetups because Nick Affolter started one. Daniel Stouse left us to become a full-time gospel preacher, and he's now out at Issaquah, and they have several going on there. And Bill Downing came to our meetup on Tuesday night and got the hang of it, along with Richard Ratke, and now the North Seattle Church is having at least one meetup and plan on having more. I just got back from Millersville, Kentucky, and was talking to them about the meetups, and they're all excited and want me to send them some pointers on how to run meetups. So Mitchell's going to be kind and put together a little handout that I can send them. Isn't it exciting how this is spreading? And it all started because Brother Nick, who's already busy, decided he was going to try something and make a difference. And thank you for all of you who put in all the time and effort to help those things to be a continuous outreach to the community. How much can one person do, particularly when you start having synergy? A lot. The Robinson family came to us in 2014. We're so thrilled to have Julian and Kim and their kids with us. And Julian's always had a heart for foreign evangelism. And so, of course, he started suggesting, would you like to help me go to Costa Rica? And any of you want to go? And now they're getting ready to have their fourth trip. And this time, one of our elders, Lyle Gradden, is going. Got eight precious souls from Kirkland leaving. You know, it's one thing to write a check and send a check overseas. And it's another thing to actually leave your comfort zone and go into a foreign mission field and pretty much work 12-hour days or more. Focused on trying to help this local church and focused on sharing the gospel overseas. Do you have some idea, Julian, how many people have been contacted or reached throughout these efforts? Okay, 20 baptisms and hundreds of people contacted, I know that, and lots of Bible studies. Can one person make a difference? I'm going to go. Will you go with me? And then people follow his faith and his zeal. Can one person do a lot? Yes, do a lot. Well, what would happen if everybody just stepped up with that same kind of spirit? Our visitors have gone from 4 or 5 to 1 week. We had over 40 visitors coming through those doors Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. Continue to pray for seekers. Persevere in that, that God will send us seekers. Continue to use those cards and invite people to come and worship with us. Because churches ultimately grow through visitor flow. And we're so glad that our visitors are with us tonight. But it's easy to become weary when you got so many things going on. Take a breath. Pace yourself. But keep going and persevere. A month or so ago, I talked about evangelism tools. And I mentioned the tool of the muscle and the shovel. As of this afternoon, they have 62,000 people that have reported after reading that study, they decided to make a decision for Christ and be baptized for the remission of their sins. All because he decided to write down his conversion experience back in the 80s. Can one person do a lot? Yes. So what I want you to do is see yourself as that person that can really make a difference. And if your heart is connected to God's heart, then you will decide you're going to do what he wants, regardless of how much time, effort, or money, or difficulties that may cause. If it's God's will, I want to be a part of God's will. And so as we look forward, it seems to me we got three choices. You can either just decide to stop building and quit, which sadly some do. I don't think any in this audience will take that choice, but that is an option when you start to get burned out. Or you can, you know, stay on the track, but just start walking around the track. Become stagnant and comfortable and deceive yourself into thinking that somehow or other that's okay. Or you can stay focused on Jesus and you can run the race and persevere, continue building and growing and working. Remembering that those who wait on the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not be weary. True story from the pages of the 19th century. There was a young man, he was actually from a pretty wealthy family, but he was a Christian. And he saw the billions of souls in China and how few Christians there were in China. And he felt committed to learn the language and to go over there and try to teach the Chinese. And everybody discouraged him. His parents said, it's too dangerous, it's too far away. You know, you can have such a good, comfortable life here. You can serve the Lord here. You don't have to go overseas. But he just felt compelled. And with very little support, he went overseas and he started preaching the gospel in China. And he had some very good results. Sadly, about 10 years later, he got sick and he ultimately died from disease. And his family, very sadly, went to China to pick up his personal effects, pick up his body so he could get buried at home. And as they went into his apartment, it was very sparsely furnished. There was a desk there and a very well-worn Bible where he obviously spent time praying and studying. Had a piece of glass on top of the desk and underneath that glass so that he would see it every time he sat down there at his place for devotion. He'd written in large capital block letters, no retreat, no reserve, no regret. No retreat, no reserve, no regret. You know, I think about the 12 apostles. 11 of the 12 wound up giving their lives up for the gospel as martyrs. But they were so focused on what they were doing. I have no doubt that on their lips, the same words could be found. Same idea. No retreat, no reserve, no regret. All they had to do was deny Christ, and they wouldn't have been executed. But they refused to deny Christ. No retreat, no reserve, no regret. And what we need more than ever, what I need more than ever, is to continue that kind of spirit and to persevere. Even though we've been running this race for years. We're so blessed to have really good shepherding here. And deacons and many members that work hard with their responsibilities and work together. My wife and I work hard with you. And when everybody is doing their part and the body is fulfilling its several part, like we're told to do in Ephesians 4, it's just amazing what God can work through us. So much more than just holding services and keeping house. But we've got to stay focused and persevere. If not us, who? If not now, when? You guys on board? And all the house of Israel said together, amen. If there's anybody here subject to the gospel, won't you come? As together we stand and we sing.